life's been so sweet to me.
Welcome to Unmindfulness. Unmindfulness is a show of the Shasta Resilience Project offered here on KKRN Community Supported Radio. On this show, we interview practitioners of mindfulness as well as people who have integrated mindfulness into their lives in different ways. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Juliet Malik, and I'm going to let her introduce herself to you. Juliet.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you so much for having me today. This is a real joy to have this conversation with you. But yeah, my name is Juliet Malik, and I am a business owner. I co-own Damburger with my sister. I am a mother of four, and I am a new grandmother of a two-week-old grandson. So exciting. And I'm a volunteer board member for Shasta Environment Alliance, and I'm also just a lifelong learner.
Yeah, and I know we'll focus a lot on the Shasta Environmental Alliance and all the things that I've learned through you about the role of what we would call mindfulness in that, you know, the environmental movement and what you're trying to create there. But first, I wanted to ask you about Damburger. Damburger is a community institution. What is it like to be part of something that has had that role over time?
Yeah. I have to admit that in my younger years, I didn't necessarily recognize that. But, you know, Damburger's been in our family since 1979. So what is that? 47 years. I have certainly grown up there, both literally and emotionally, too. I don't think anything tests your emotional regulation better than engaging with the public. So,
very true.
Yeah. I think it's a real honor, actually. You know, restaurant work is hard, but Damburger is so special. And the fact that it is a community institution, it is a historical institution, it is a place of gathering, it is a place of nostalgia. You just make so many amazing connections with customers, and then you see the connections that they have with other customers, and you just start to really see the web of community in a place like that. And yeah, it's just really special.
What have you learned along the way about community and connection?
I would say that I have learned that community and connection must be nurtured. Mm. You can't take it for granted. And the example I have is that during when the car fire hit, that was a moment where I really saw the community. I really saw how much people were there for each other. It did not matter where you came from, who you voted for, any of that stuff. Everyone was showing up and helping each other out. And I was so just in love with it. I was like, oh, I just love this community so much. And then less than 2 years after that, the COVID pandemic hit, and I saw a lot of fracturing. I saw people, you know, taking sides, and people who had always been kind to me in the past were pretty blunt, I'll just put it kindly, to me about, you know, following the state mandates, which were so hard in the beginning because they were changing daily and we were just doing our best and none of us had all the information. And so I just really saw such a different, both sides of what it means for community and connection and how it has to be taken care of. You have to nurture it. It has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. I still think that this overwhelmingly is a very loving community. Most people are really believing in that we're in this together. But it was interesting. It was really interesting to see those two sides of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I've thought about at times, like in our country, things that happened, say in the aftermath of 9/11, and then again, that turn, but there's so much to be learned that we could be nurturing from those moments after. Like you're saying, a lot of the best of us came out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just tremendous to see, like, people. And I feel like Danburger was a special place because we did open up immediately after that terrible night that we all experienced, and we didn't know what to do. We were just like, okay, let's just give people food because we have food. We can do that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of restaurants did that. And it was, yes, it was really, it was very inspiring, to see that. And it was really nice to see both, you know, these traumatized people who'd lost their homes and also like people who were coming in to say, how can I help? Mm-hmm. Like coming to me specifically and saying, giving me their name and phone number and saying, anyone who needs help, give them my information. Total strangers. I loved that. I love that. And I think that does exist. I see it all the time in our customer community, you know, with all the, angry talk about, you know, homelessness or something. And yet every day I see somebody buying an unhoused person a lunch. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there's a great deal of kindness in this community and I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I like what you said earlier too about, or, you know, you imply the importance of self-regulating mm-hmm. in order to be able to both witness that, mm-hmm. to be present to it, and to get into that space yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. We have our little lizard brain that gets threatened and gets really defensive, and we can really focus on those negative times, which are few and far between. Because if you really stop and think about it, like throughout a shift at Danburger, you might have one customer that gets in your face and is angry that you put mustard on the burger and they didn't want mustard on the burger. Right. And it'll stick with you all day. But if you pause and go, wait, but I also had all these wonderful conversations with customers who were talking about how much they love this place and how happy they were to see me. And just those are that's where I think mindfulness is really useful. And I try, well, you know, the manager and I and my sister, we really try to like teach that to our employees, like, hey, overwhelmingly, our customers are really nice, really supportive, really focus on those interactions. And, you know, the ones that are hard, it's not even about you, you know, but it's hard. It's really hard to not take things personally when somebody gets in your face.
Yeah. So this community institution that's been a part of your life and part of our community for 47 years, you and your sister in the process of selling. What's that like to let go of that? There's identity there. There's the conversations, the connection with community. What's it like for you and what's helping you?
Well, this has been years of conversation and back and forth between me and my sister of like realizing that we'd gotten to a place where we had other things that we wanted to do in life. And, it wasn't fair to us or to Danburger to try to split our attention. We're both too young to fully retire, so we know that we have to find other means of making money after the sale. But the bigger questions really were much more personal and emotional. It was like, wow, this is like such a part of me. I mean, you know, it's been, I think I was 7 or 8 when my parents bought the place. And so it's just like, it's like home. I mean, I'm out and about in town and I'm thirsty. I stop at Danburger when it's closed and go get an iced tea. Like, it's just like, it's like walking to my own house, you know, it's like, it's so personal. And then, you know, you mentioned identity. That's a big one. There's a sense of that I belong in this community when I say, oh, I own Danburger. And people are like, oh, that's amazing. I love that place, you know, or, oh, I've heard of that place and I want to try it. And to let go of that's kind of hard, but I also recognize it's a little bit of an ego thing too. But I think what's helping me is understanding that Danburger has sort of surpassed being a business in the sense that when I think about what Danburger is, calling it a business is actually kind of lower down on the list. You know, all those other things that I mentioned about community institution, historical institution, place of gathering, place of welcoming. And so I realized that I'm less of an owner and more of a steward of this place. And so I can let go because I know that it will continue on without me, that the right person will come along and will also steward this incredible place, hopefully to its 100th birthday and beyond. I'm so excited for that. I'm excited to be, you know, on the customer side of that when that celebration comes about. So I think that's really helping me let go, is just realizing like, oh, it doesn't actually belong to me in a sense. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KKRN Community Supported Radio on Mindfulness, and my guest is Juliet Malik. It's beautiful what you just said. It really ties into some of the questions I have about the Shasta Environmental Alliance and that sense of whatever it is you do, you can create that belonging, a space for stewardship of all kinds, that we don't have to put things in a box, that you have to be this sort of nonprofit or in order to serve these really social justice, these broader social justice issues, to make your community a better place. To begin, tell us about the Shasta Environmental Alliance.
I joined about a year and a half ago, and there's been a big shift, you know, kind of a several board members leaving, new ones coming on. So we're in this kind of really exciting transitional phase. It's just Environmental Alliance started, was founded in 2017 by David Ledger and Melinda Brown as a way to create a unified environmental voice for our area. I think one of the pressing issues then and continues to be today is the loss of natural habitat and our native oak woodlands, tree canopy. We are losing these at a somewhat alarming rate, where the city was just approving development projects left and right that were bulldozing hundreds and thousands of native oak trees. And, you know, to see the pictures of what that whole new Costco development looked like before it became the Costco development, it's honestly, it's kind of heartbreaking. That was a big motivation. And so a lot of the past actions were around advocating for a better tree ordinance in this city that actually had some mitigation tied into it, so that if developers did cut down a certain number of trees or size of trees, they would have to pay for that. There was a tree campaign where we got a grant and offered out free shade trees to people living in Redding. You know, a lot of nature or environmental education through like naturalist-led walks, teaching people about, you know, who are our non-human neighbors, you know, including the plants and the animals. And, you know, when you start to learn more about that, you learn to care more about that. So I came on actually in October of 2024. I had previously volunteered a little bit for the organization. And in 2023, I actually got my, I became a certified California naturalist.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it sounds really lofty, kind of. But it's available to anybody who's interested. It's a, it costs money, so maybe not everybody, but through the UC Environmental Stewards Program that's run through the Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources. I've always loved nature. And as I was thinking about what it meant to shift away from doing Damberger work, I was like, well, what do I love? And I'm like, oh, I just love being a nature nerd. That's what I want to be. That's what I want to do. So I took the class, and the purpose of the class is to create a volunteer corps throughout California for environmental, you know, education and stewardship and advocacy and conservation, all these things. So I reached out to SEA to find out, you know, how I could help, what I could do. And my first volunteer thing was to do a citizen science project called an iNaturalist BioBlitz. iNaturalist is an app or a program, international database, really, for community members to go out and take pictures of what they see. That's anything that's not domestic, like, you know, not pictures of people and not pictures of your pets, but like, you know, any other living organism, wild organism, and you upload it, and it has an algorithm that will help you identify all the way down to species level. But what's really cool about it is that there's a community of people that are reviewing these observations, and, you know, like, so, you know, botanists and entomologists and people who really know can like look at these pictures and confirm the identity down to species level. And then it becomes research grade, and then it becomes just this massive database for people, for just anyone from the curious to, you know, the researcher, wanting to know about species, you know, distribution and biodiversity in areas and stuff. Mm. So it's really, and it's fun. It's like, for the younger people who know what Pokemon Go is, it feels very much like you're just going out and collecting as many species as you can. And it's really fun when you get that interaction and you get somebody that knows what they're talking about saying, oh yeah, that's what this is. And you're like, yes. Yeah. And then eventually I became friends with one of the board members and she pulled me in. And I'm happy to be part of the organization, even if, you know, it is a lot of work and there's very few of us. There's only six of us right now. And we definitely would like more people. It truly is a labor of love. And each of these of my, you know, fellow board members are passionate and dedicated. And we are so full of amazing ideas. but we need more people, you know, there's a lot of work to be done and we need more people to like help us get this work done. And it's fun though. A lot of our ideas are like, you know, they're joyful and they, you know, you're connected to other people. And yeah, I'm excited. I'm really excited to see where we go from here.
There are many, many things that you can do, and actually acting and being in community with other like-minded people is incredibly uplifting, gives us hope, can lead to more collective action.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the number one thing I just say to people is like, well, I feel overwhelmed by what's going on in the world. I don't know how to help. And I'm like, well, the first thing you need to do is find your community, you know, research whatever organizations support your values and the things that you care about and reach out to them. Because I guarantee you, especially the nonprofits are all just eagerly waiting for people to say, hey, I like what you're doing. I want to help. I know that we do when we get a random email that's just like, hey, I love what you guys are doing. And I want to be involved. And we're so quick to respond to say, yes, you're welcome. Please let's join us and let's find a place for you. Cause there's a place for absolutely everyone. I would really like to point out that I have no formal education in the natural sciences, you know, and yet I lead naturalist walks because I think, you know, I've learned a lot with each walk. I learn more. I learn from some of the participants of the walks, you know, that know more of the plant names than I do or such things. What's important is the enthusiasm and the willingness and the passion for it. And so I just really encourage people, if you care about what's happening to our environment and what's happening regarding climate, that's enough. That's really enough.
you shared with me a book, and you have a book club. Shasta Environmental Alliance is a book club that's addressing it. It's called What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures by Ayana, I believe is her name, Elizabeth Johnson. Why did you all choose that book? And what have been some of the important conversations that have come out of it so far?
Yeah, great question. So in addition to doing the UC California Naturalist Program, last year I did the UC Climate Stewardship class, which again is, you know, asking people to go out into the community and do and figure out a way to engage with local collective climate action. And so my stewardship project for that class was creating this book club for Shasta Environmental Alliance. And that book was just top of my mind because I had heard of it, because I had read All We Can Save, which was an anthology that Dr. Ayana Elizabeth Johnson did with Dr. Catherine Wilkinson. What I learned in that class is that you really have to stay on the solution side when you're doing climate communication. And that book is all about solutions. We could sit around and commiserate for hours about how dire our situation is and all walk away feeling really depressed and hopeless and, you know, give up. But when you start talking about what's out there solutions-wise, you get energized. You realize, wait a minute, we could get this right. Also, we're not powerless. Yes, we need to stop using fossil fuels. We need to stop deforestation. These are huge, huge global level, you know, actions that need to happen. As individuals, we're not going to stop Exxon from being Exxon. But at the community level, we can come together and we can find ways to increase our local biodiversity. We can engage with our city about better energy choices or supporting more solar installation. You know, these are things that we can do. And if you think about it, yes, we want to save the whole planet, but we also need to make where we live better, safer places to live. And so that's where we start. And that action and that energy is contagious and it spreads. We talk about what's presented in the book, and then we talk about what does that look like at the local level. And it's been really fun and also just like enlightening. And I think the last meeting, I think I was starting to see how we can start creating sort of an action list, like, okay, we're learning all these things. What does it look like to do something locally? So that is my ultimate goal, is that action comes from these conversations. Mm-hmm. Everything that exists came from imagination, our imagination. So we can imagine a better future. We can imagine and create, you know, the opposite of what, you know, the forces at play are driving us towards. And I think that's just really important to hold on to that, to not give up.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard people talk about really what we have is a crisis of imagination, you know, perhaps some will, but being able to see solutions. Mm-hmm. How are people grappling with bringing together the personal and the systems change?
Yeah. I think it's been really interesting. We have a nice diversity of age on this, in this book club, you know, from 30s all the way, maybe even someone in their 20s, I'm not sure, all the way up into the, you know, retirement age and stuff. And so it's really interesting to see those different perspectives. The systems level is tough. We all recognize it. We all recognize that the system is against this. But there's small ways of sort of bucking the system that I think we get kind of encouraged by. Shasta Environmental Alliance teamed up with the Western Shasta Resource Conservation District, and we did kind of a buy nothing event, basically invited people to bring the things that you don't need anymore, put them on a table. The community is welcome to come, take what you like, no money exchange at all. And that's just a little small act of saying, of sort of circumventing the system, right? You know, this isn't about making money. This isn't about getting your fair share. You know, it takes us back to the sharing is caring that you learned in kindergarten, which sounds so simple, but is also really antithetical to the current economic model. And we're thinking a lot about those kind of events. Like, we want to figure out how to do like a repair cafe type event, where we bring people who have repair skills and invite the community. Like, hey, do you have, I don't know, a toaster oven that stopped working, or, you know, just like these little appliances that we're basically taught now to just toss and replace, you know, it's ridiculous. What happened to Mr. Hooper from Sesame Street? Right. Where are our fix-it shops? So these are all ways that I feel that people get kind of excited when they go, oh yeah, no, the system is big and it's hard to push against. But again, at the local level, there's lots of ways that we can sort of start inviting people to a different vision of what community life looks like, you know?
Yeah, that would be a great event.
Yeah.
I heard another podcast where the original creator of the Whole Earth catalog has a more recent book on repair.
Oh.
And for that very reason, like, we throw away so many things and then we're consuming the same things because either we don't know or we don't think about repairing what we have. And it builds community as well, too.
Yeah, I see it also as possibly being a really wonderful, like multi-generational event where I'm picturing, you know, grandmothers with sewing machines and helping people mend their clothes instead of like just tossing them, like, and then teaching these skill sets. And I'm so inspired actually by the younger generation. I'm meeting so many young people that are really into like these sort of kind of like, you know, pioneer days type like activities of like, you know, sewing and knitting and canning and you know,
like
herbalist. Just all these different things that like our grandmothers or great grandmothers, that was just life for them. But those skills just kind of didn't get passed on, like, I mean, through our generations very, very much. And now they're coming back. And that's really inspiring too.
Yeah. And that intergenerational, that can be hard to find in community gatherings. And it's a critical element of diversity, really, because we have different experiences and different perspectives, and certainly the messaging is different. That's really beautiful that you have that coming together.
Yeah, I hope we do. Again, we need more people.
Right. Well, we're going to put a call out for people in a second. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to On Mindfulness, and I'm in conversation with Juliette Malik. And we're talking about her role in the Shasta Environmental Alliance. So you mentioned some of the things that have been bubbling up in the in your meetings and in the book club, as well as, you know, I'm sure there have been interesting solutions or ideas coming up in the book. What are some ideas that you can share with listeners, either that surprised you or struck you, or are kind of examples of fairly easy access to doing something?
Well, because I'm a big old nature dork, my favorite solutions in the book so far have been the nature-inspired solutions. And some of these are not necessarily accessible to like the individual, but like, but certainly people who do work in restoration, like beaver dam analogs, right? Like humans are going out and pretending to be beavers. I mean, how wonderful is that? Because we've recognized how important beavers are to aquatic ecosystems. That is beautiful to me. Just recognizing the value in different like ecosystem functions and the critters that are responsible for that. Other solutions. I mean, increasing biodiversity is really important, and that's actually pretty accessible for people. I mean, it can start in your yard, like learning about local native plants and maybe converting, if you've got lawn, maybe converting some of that lawn into a native plant garden. One, it will be rewarding in the sense that it'll be beautiful, and it will encourage more wildlife and more native pollinators. It will also save you water on your water bill. And we all know in California how precious water is. So lawns are a huge water sponge. Like they are just high water demand. So it's beneficial economically and also like environmentally. What I like to think about is imagining that if you're doing that in a neighborhood and your neighbors are curious, oh, what are you doing? And you start talking to your neighbors, and then you get more people on board, and you build a whole wildlife corridor. Because if you're the only native plant garden in a whole neighborhood of lawns, you know, that wildlife won't necessarily find you. They need more. So I think about that a lot, about the ways that we can do that as individuals, but also how it can expand pretty easily into like your neighbors and to other community members. And maybe you get people who are passionate of like, hey, let's figure out how to do a community native garden. We need more of those. So yeah, increasing biodiversity is a big one. Other things too that I thought were really interesting is where we put our money. I'm not a money person. I don't like to think about money, which is a funny thing to say as a business owner.
I'm with you. Yeah.
But where we put our money is powerful. And a lot of people don't realize that big banking institutions are huge polluters. They finance fossil fuel infrastructure and other projects. And so one of the things that in the book that was mentioned, I think it was Bill McKibben, said, when you drive by your big banks in your community, imagine huge smokestacks on top of them, because that's what they are. Mm-hmm. And so really like moving your money into like more locally centralized, like credit unions. There's also online clean energy credit unions these days, like really researching that, because that's important too. Cause we do have some power with where we put our money. I liked that solution a lot too.
Mm. You know, when we talk about, and I heard actually on the way over here, an interview on NPR of a candidate for, you know, assembly person, and talking a lot about reducing fossil fuels in the forest, and almost the suggestion that's kind of the reason for our fires, and certainly can contribute to it. There wasn't talk about the extreme weather that we're seeing and some of the changes that have occurred over time. Climate change has been one of those issues that in the past there's been believers or deniers. It was interesting in the book to see surveying research that most people are not climate change deniers anymore, right? that there's an acknowledgement that, oh, things are changing. We're having these extreme weather events, although there can always be difference on what to do about it. Mm-hmm. In the past, it seemed like it's been really tentative how you approach education about the extreme weather. And what are you and your group, what are you thinking about how to engage people who may have very different ideas about solution, who are maybe focused on we need to clean up our forest, which could be very true, but as a solution to all wildfire issues. How do you begin that?
Yeah, well, that is probably a question that it rolls around my brain constantly. But I will say that from the climate stewardship class, I did learn some real basics of climate communication that I think are really important. And first off is you really want to find your shared values with that other person or group of people. That's where you want to start. The other thing is like using stories to talk about these issues, because throwing facts and figures and graphs and charts at people does not necessarily persuade all that well. Although people, I mean, we should all have a baseline understanding of what's happening in the world of climate science and why we're in the situation that we're in. But ultimately, you know, climate change is one of those topics that it is a scientific topic, but it's also, it's an emotional topic. And you can't just come in hot with, this is what's happening right now, and we need to act now, and we need to change things and stuff. You have to be really mindful of the really intense emotions that go along with this, whether you're a skeptic or maybe you're just sort of in the middle where you're like, oh, I think it's real, but I don't think there's anything we can do about it. You know, or a full-on denier, there's strong, strong emotions there. Fear, anger, grief are the big three. You have to recognize that. I think in our group, we have talked about like having these conversations takes practice. You're not going to get it right the first time, probably, when you're engaging with somebody that's pushing against what you believe is like a possible future. And seeing that other person, recognizing where they're coming from emotionally, is it fear? Is it anger? Is it grief? You know, it could be grief of losing, they're afraid of losing a life that they're used to, right? This is a big conversation about like climate action. It's like, well, you're trying to take away all the things that I enjoy in life. But that's not true, actually. That's the whole point of like this book, is to be like, no, we can find climate solutions that still allow us to have a really joyful life and enjoy the things that already exist. We're just going to do them in a different way. Mm-hmm. I recently did have one of these conversations. And it was, even though I'd taken this class and I'd learned what I was supposed to do, that emotional reactivity just wells up so quickly. And I found myself being very reactive and very just like, well, why don't we just all give up then? You know, and I was just like, and then I took a really deep breath and I saw the person and I saw that he actually does care about where we're going in the future. He just is getting kind of some wonky information about what is possible. And so, you know, once I paused and just like really saw that, then we had a conversation that it was about like the reality of like, you know, what is accessible to us. And that was a good learning experience. It was hard, mm-hmm. but yeah, I think that's just, you'd really got to bring it back to common values and shared stories. Mm-hmm. Like if you're into skiing, what has your experience been in the past few years of like, you know, how long has the season been at Mount Shasta? It's not been very long. So these are things that are impacting people. Even if they don't want to call it climate change, it's still happening to them.
Mm-hmm. Or fishing, mm-hmm. or hunting, or or hiking backcountry if you're afraid of, you know, fires.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And when it's dry, you're just like, how do I get out of here if a fire starts?
Mm-hmm. I know I'm planning a trip right now and I'm thinking, okay, do I need a solar charger?
Right.
That piece, I think, is really underestimated. The emotional, the emotions that are embedded within a lot of conversations, the emotions that well up in that person and that well up in ourselves, mm-hmm. as we're talking to them. And you mentioned pausing, which, of course, is so important, mm-hmm. to re-regulating and to being mindful. Are there any other practices and breathing mm-hmm. that you pull in the moment when those kind of things happen?
The pausing and the breathing is the big thing. And then I kind of ask myself, okay, what is really going on here? Mm-hmm. What is this, you know, emotional response really about? And that helps kind of like, guide me forward, you know, like, oh, I'm too fixated on changing this person's mind. And like, I don't need to change their mind. I just need to hear them. Mm-hmm. I need to let them know that they are heard and that they are seen. That is something that has come up in our book club about like, that's what most people want.
Yes.
Most people just want to feel heard. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that and then making space for that. So that's a big thing for me as well.
Mm-hmm. You can't develop the kind of trust that we need to be vulnerable, mm-hmm. with each other. And discussing a topic that brings up such important emotions is about your future, mm-hmm. and your children's future and their decisions, like whether or not we have kids or where we move or what we do.
Right.
There's a real need for compassion and empathy and listening.
There really is. And, you know, I these conversations are so interesting and important. I mean, one of the things, a message that has been given to me is that climate change is, you know, like the greatest existential threat right now for all of life on the planet. And yet we're not really talking about it all that much. It's like less than 1% of our media cycle.
I saw that.
It's alarming. How much we're avoiding this. And some of it is intentional, right? Because the people that are benefiting from keeping the status quo don't want us to be talking about it.
And control a lot
and
of
control,
the media
yeah,
sites.
And all that. And then the other part is that it's hard. Climate change is like, it's slow moving. So you're like, you know, like today I woke up, it's beautiful outside. I'm not looking outside and thinking of climate change when I see the blue sky and the birds are singing and the trees are in leaf and all that stuff. So it can be really, it's like almost a cognitive dissonance of like knowing this is happening, but not necessarily seeing it in front of your face until some disastrous thing is happening. Then you're thinking about it. So it's such a whiplash emotionally. I think that's the challenge, really. And that's, again, I think bringing it back to a local level makes it a little bit more digestible. Because then you can see like, okay, Reading, we have extreme heat. That's such an important topic for us to address. Protecting our, and in relation to that, protecting our tree canopy. That's super important. Trees are, you know, obviously for shade, but they're regulating air temperature and they're, cleaning the air and they're, you know, like, you know, part of the water cycle as well. Like these are all really important issues that, people I think do know and care about.
The other thing that jumped out to me in the portion that I've been reading of the book is that in this country, there are 11 million voters, people who are registered to vote, who cite environmental concerns as their top issue, but who did not vote in the last large, you know, national election in 2024. And it's another example of what we purchase, what we do if we vote and how we vote can have a big impact. 11 million is... That's a big number.
That's significant, yeah.
Right, and they may not all vote exactly the same, but and voting is not as sufficient to sustaining a democracy or being a citizen, but it's can have pretty important consequences, I think, as we've seen.
I agree, and with, you know, ongoing threats to our right to vote, maybe is waking people up and saying, I'm going to exercise my civic right while I still have it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier interacting with nature and people getting out into nature. And you and I spoke about the concept, both in this book and I'm sure in your studies, about biophilia. That I guess E.O. Wilson was one of the people who coined it. I think it's a beautiful concept. I was hoping you could share with listeners what it is and what you like about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way I think about biophilia is that there is sort of an innate tendency for us to seek connection to the natural world. And I also think of it as love. And I thank you to Robin Wall Kimmerer, you know, indigenous scholar, teacher, lover of the world, who has taught us through her many books about that not only do we love nature, but nature loves us back. So I love the act of reciprocity there. And I think that's what I think about the most, is that it can be easy to go out and be really appreciative. Hopefully it's easy for most people to go out and be really appreciative of, you know, the spring growth, you know, that we've been witnessing for the past several weeks, and all the new wildflowers, and the birds are just really going off and protecting their nests, and all the new babies that are being born. It's just like, all of it is so beautiful. Like spring is such a time of just like really, you know, experiencing that joy. But just all of that happening is like an act of love towards us as well, you know, and that is meaningful to me. And I think if Mother Nature can show up for me every day, then I am obligated to show up for her in any way I can. And that's kind of where I go with some of my, maybe not so directly, but like, you know, like subtly in my naturalist led walks and stuff. Sometimes I'll print up like a plant list or a bird list. And I put that quote from Robin Wall Kimmerer that, paying attention is an act of reciprocity. And that's where it begins. Just paying attention to the world around you. You know, curiosity and observation and curiosity are the two biggest tools of a naturalist, I think.
Yeah, that, and there's such, I mean, that's a automatic pause and connection. I was walking with a friend in Brandy Creek Trail yesterday, and at the very beginning, I was thinking of our conversation, the conversation we had had earlier, and I was kind of in my head, and my friend kept stopping, look at these, and she knew all the plants, and she named them, and I had walked right past them, and it was really instructive. I noticed the trees and the creek and the sky a lot, but there were so many flowers that when I was in my head, I didn't even notice.
Yeah.
A completely different experience when you connect.
Yeah. No, I mean, I relate to that so much because I go for walks sometimes to let my brain sort of work through stuff, right? But as I've gotten more engaged with like, you know, naturalist type observations and stuff, I do stop myself. I literally physically stop myself on the trail and be like, wow, where have I been for the last like 10 minutes? Right. And I look around. I'm like, what do I see? And what do I hear? Like, who's out here right now? Who's singing? Who's talking? Who's chattering? Who's buzzing? And a big one for me too is that I am so enamored with like the way light interacts with the environment, like I just at different times of the day and just seeing like, you know, light and shadow and just like, the reflection off of tree leaves and just the movement there. I mean, just, it's a sense of awe that never is just, it's always, it just comes back to me so immediately when I just stop and just, and pay attention and just like, wait, where am I? Who am I with right now? You know, what beings are here with me right now? Trees, plants, birds, bugs, whatever it is.
Yeah, that sense of awe. I read a book a while ago titled Awe, and it was it was many things, but walking into that sense of reimagining or radical imagination.
Yeah.
I don't know if it makes it easier or it's impossible to do without having that awe. There was a woman biologist who made Evelyn Fox Keller, I believe, who made these incredible discoveries. And when she would talk about how she was able to learn from the corn, the mice that she was studying, she would say something to like, well, it's love. I loved the grains of corn and I connected with them and sort of that reciprocity that you're talking about that Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's accessible, you know, nature in some form can be accessible to everyone. It's harder if you live in a inner city or in an apartment and can't get out very much, but we can still bring it in. Like what are some ways that you've seen people make those connections even when there's a lot of constraint?
Yeah. I think it comes down to first the desire to, and then making an intention. So, I mean, wherever you are, stepping outside and getting curious, what is right outside your front door? And again, that can be really hard if you are living like, you know, deep in the city and it's very concrete and stuff, but you know, finding that one tree, maybe who's in that tree? Do you hear any birds singing? You know, we always, you know, there's, you know, the flowers, which may be weeds or whatever, popping up through the cracks in the sidewalk and just like recognizing just the persistence of nature, even as, you know, we keep trying to pave over her, but you know, these plants find their way. I think, you know, also people just seeking out those organizations or those community groups that are engaged in you know, appreciating nature or environmental work or climate work and stuff like that is a really good one, a good way. And then also like if you have the space to even have just one potted plant a native plant or a vegetable plant or something mm-hmm. that, you know, and nurture that, like just that right there is so instructive and so nurturing for us, putting your hands in the dirt and watching something grow and nurturing it and caring for it. Like that's another great way mm-hmm. to be connected.
Mm-hmm. What are some resources that you would suggest to people if they're thinking like, oh, I definitely want to learn a lot more. Where do I start? Mm. And then, of course, I'm going to follow it up with what could people do if they join you? How could they get involved in change?
You know, there is so much out there as far as books and podcasts and films and stuff. But some of the things that have taught me and informed me have been podcasts like A Matter of Degrees and How to Save a Planet, California, Golden State Naturalist. She's based out of Sacramento. She also took the UC California Naturalist course and transitioned. This is now her job. She was an English teacher and now she's full-time running, this podcast and doing so much amazing, like, you know, environmental education through Instagram and her podcast. And she's become very highly connected throughout the state. It's amazing. It's wonderful to see that. And also you just learn so much about, you know, our local, like, you know, flora and fauna. You know, books, I mean, anything by Robin Wall Kimmerer, I will say, is worth reading. She has a new children's book out, so people with kids should probably check that out.
Oh, nice.
Also, people for kids, I would highly recommend the Terrestrials podcast, which is, I think, like a partner podcast with Radiolab, if I have that right. I think I do. Lulu Miller. It's so fun. You don't have to be a kid to listen to it. I love listening to it. Catherine Hayhoe is a really good author on climate science, but she also comes from a place of faith, though, of Christian faith. So that's really, I think, accessible for a lot of people. Kate Marvel, I think, has a new book or new-ish book called Human Nature. Some of these I haven't read. Bill McKibben is hugely prolific and has been, obviously, for decades really involved in this movement. There's a lot out there. There's kind of no shortage, but the internet can also just be this like overwhelming sea of information and trying to like dial it into something that's like,
I can put some of those that you mentioned in the show notes so people can go there.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's some that I'm missing, but,
but those sound like good places to start.
Yeah, I think those are good places to start. For sure.
And what would be your invitation to people about Shasta Environmental Alliance or some examples of... I do find people think like, oh, well, I don't know a lot, or I arrange flowers, or this is my passion. Mm-hmm. They don't need that. Like, how do you invite people to use what they love, as Angela Davis says, in service of something that's important to them?
Yeah, I think that's really important is recognizing some people will say, well, I don't have skills that are related to this. It's totally not true. the other thing too is recognizing, like I just heard Gina McCarthy say, all impactful action is ground up, not top down. So knowing that you are absolutely part of that, that you are welcome in that space, is important. Cause like, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, she has that Venn diagram, right? Of like the three circles. What do you love? What are you good at? What needs to be done? And that intersection is like, that's your climate action. Love that. So I would say to people, we are looking for people of all kinds of interests and skill sets. And obviously it's really great if like you're a lawyer, you know how to navigate like legal, environmental legal issues, that's wonderful. And if you're maybe, you know, really involved with like, you know, political lobbying or something, you know how to like navigate the political system. I mean, those are really big, heavy skills. And we're certainly looking for those people, but we're also just looking for people who care. We're looking for people who are passionate. We're looking for people who are interested. And we are a really fun group, and we're really working on developing a much more collaborative governance structure rather than a, you know, to really mimic that power of bottom up as opposed to top down. So I just, you know, want people to know that it's like, yeah, come in and join, you know, join us, like reach out to us. We obviously we're building sort of this like climate angle with the book club. We talk a lot about biodiversity, from, you know, that naturalist education type stuff. We're talking about sustainability is a big one, you know, the repair, event and more events like that. We also want to get people in touch with like our local systems, hoping to do like a tour out at the, recycling and food composting so people understand this is what you discard in your cans, here's where it goes, here's what's done with it. Like, we just need to understand all of these things. And we're also working on putting together like a fun family-friendly event, a film event, film screening of The Extraordinary Caterpillar. That's teaches people about the importance of the little tiny creatures in the food web and how like these matter. You know, we don't want our food web to, you know, to collapse. So many fun things to do, and it really just takes willingness, you know, and a passion to do that kind of stuff.
Well, that's a great place to wrap up. Is there anything else I should have asked you that I didn't?
I don't think so. I guess I should maybe tell people how to get in touch with us, if that's okay. So our website is ecoshasta.org. And on that website, you can find links to sign up for our free newsletter. You can also find like a contact page to where you can email us directly. You can do info@ecoshasta.org. Yeah, we're so excited about what's coming up. We're going to launch a new website soon, and we've got so many ideas, and we're just really excited to invite people to our table. You know, let's get to work. Let's have fun doing it.
Let's.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Juliet, so much for speaking with us. And you've been listening to On Mindfulness on KKRN, Community Supported Radio, my conversation with Juliet Malik of Shasta Environmental Alliance. And please check them out on the website, support their cause, and support this station. You can find more about us on kkrn.org.
Don't you want me to be happy? Don't you want me to be unafraid? Don't you want me to follow all my dreams? Don't you want me always to say, oh, life? Life's been